Good afternoon, calling State Affairs to order at 10:06 a.m. Saturday, April 16, 2022. We're in the Max Grunberg Room of the Alaska Capitol, and members present in the room from my right, Representatives Eastman and Story, and myself, Chair Christ Tompkins, and then online we have Representative Vance and Representative Tarr. We may be joined by Representative Kaufman and Klayman in due time, but that gives us five members present in form to conduct business. We have five items on today's agenda, but before we get there, I want to restate an amendment deadline for SB 161 relating to political party definition. Amendments should be submitted by members to Legislative Legal by Tuesday at 5 p.m. and submitted to my office by Wednesday at 5 p.m. this coming week if you seek to offer amendments on that piece of legislation. This takes us to the five items on today's agenda. The first is a confirmation hearing for Ole Larson, State Board of Parole, followed by SB 182, a second hearing from Senator Wilson relating to interference with emergency services, followed by Representative Kaufman's HB 316. I believe Representative Kaufman will be online, but Matthew Harvey, his staff, will be here in person, followed by HB 256, Law Enforcement Registry and Use of Force from Representative Tarr, and finally SB 156, relating to COVID vaccines. Senator Reinbold will be here, as well as Kelly Toth, staff to Senator Reinbold. In terms of time budgeting, we'll do the confirmation hearing, and then my intent is to allocate about 30-minute chunks to each of the four pieces of legislation for their hearing today, and we should run a little over 2 hours accordingly. So we'll start off with the confirmation hearing for Ole Larson. If you can hear us, looks like you're online, please go ahead, put yourself on record.
Hi.
And maybe give the committee a little bit background about yourself and your interest in serving on the State Board of Parole.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Richard Ole Larson, better known as Ole Larson. I graduated from the University of Nebraska at Omaha with a Bachelor's of Science. I obtained a secondary teaching certification from the University of Alaska at Anchorage. I started my career in the Department of Corrections as a youth counselor working with juveniles at McLaughlin Youth Center in 1976, where I worked the boys' detention unit and the closed treatment unit. I transferred to adult corrections early in 1980s, working at the Palmer Correctional Center as a correctional officer, a shift supervisor, and a facility administrator. I also worked at the Goose Bay Correctional Center at the end of the Kinnick at the old Nike site. That facility is no longer in existence. I was promoted to an assistant superintendent at the State Correctional Center Annex, known as the 6th and C Jail, and I also oversaw the 3rd Avenue Jail. Both of those facilities are no longer in existence. I transferred back to Palmer Correctional Center as an assistant superintendent. Then in the early 90s, I worked as an assistant superintendent at the Matsu Pretrial Facility and the Cook Inlet Pretrial Facility. Cook Inlet Pretrial Facility is now part of the Anchorage Complex. I then transferred over to Highland Mountain Correctional Center, and eventually I was promoted to superintendent of Matsu Pretrial. I also worked as a superintendent at Fairbanks Correctional Center and the Point McKenzie Farm. I retired with 29 plus years in 2005. In 2008, I was elected to the Matanuska Borough School Board as a school board member. I'm on my third year term as a school board member. I have served as vice president and president of the school board. In 2010, I was appointed to Alaska Parole Board, where I served 2 5-year terms on that board. In 2020, I joined the Nakamoto Group out of Massachusetts. The Nakamoto Group, Inc. is a contracting company that hires correctional professionals to work in ICE detention facilities to ensure compliance with performance-based national detention standards. My assignments were all over the states, any detention center that housed ICE detainees. I'm currently on sabbatical with that leave pending this outcome of the confirmation hearing. I bring to the Alaska Board, Alaska Parole Board, 29 years experience in Alaska Department of Corrections. Then 10 years I served on Alaska Parole Board and 2 years working with the Nakamoto Group. Also 14 years on the Matsu Borough School Board. And I served 3 years in the 90s on the MEA Manusco Electric Board. I have the time and the desire to serve on the parole board. I feel I can give back to the state of Alaska what the state has offered me, myself, and my family. I'm eager and willing to serve. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Larson, for that introduction. There are questions from the committee. Representative Story.
Thank you for your service to the state of Alaska through the chair. This is Rep. Story, and thank you for your service to the school board. I don't know, Mr. Larson, if you remember meeting me through school board service, but we have had some interactions through that. And thank you for recapping your state service. I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit more about your time on the parole board and what sort of results that you have given to the incarcerated citizens that come before you, sort of any like summaries of decisions you've generally made on those coming before you asking for parole.
We would receive, when I was on the parole board, we would receive their files anywhere between a week and 10 days before. So I would take the file, I would read the file, and they were anywhere from probably a dozen pages to a couple hundred. And I would read through the files, looking from the beginning of their history, such as their education. And it was amazing to me how an individual would drop out of school, say around the 8th or 9th grade, 10th grade, and then look at their family history, their criminal history, read the victim's reports, and try to read and take notes at the same time, because a normal run would be 50 inmates. So I would take notes so I could refer back to them. And the way I look at an individual that steps in front of the parole board is it's their opportunity to sell themselves to the parole board to get in a discretionary parole or an early release, especially if it's a person that has been in prison for a lengthy period of time, being 15 to 30 years. That's their opportunity. And to be thoroughly vested in knowing them before they show up and to find out what they did while incarcerated, programs that they have completed, disciplines that they may have had, and take a look at that person as a holistic and then decide if they would be a good citizen or a chance that they would not get back into drugs or anything like that or commit crimes. Also, the victim's letters and the support letters take into a big consideration also. As far as the other question you asked, as far as decisions, the decisions are not easy. You have to really, it's almost a judicial type decision to figure out if a person should serve more time incarcerated or be able to get out in society. So sometimes we will put restrictions on them to assure they can work, because a lot of these guys and gals have spent decades in prison, and when they get out of prison, it's pretty unfamiliar and pretty scary and a lot of work. So you try to put the assistance there for them to succeed.
Follow up?
Yes, thank you, through the chair. I'm sorry, I'm not understanding the whole process so much. And I'm wondering if there is someone from the Department of Corrections who gives a report to the parole board on their recommendation, if that step happens.
Okay. Through the chair, what happens is there will be five of us sitting in the parole hearing. There will be parole staff, and then a probation officer will be there to present. There will be a probation officer recommendation letter, be with the inmate to present during a discretionary. If it is a revocation hearing, which is they violated parole, then they can have an attorney there along with a probation officer to represent them. They don't show up in front of the board without representation, either parole officer. And usually before a discretionary hearing, the parole officer will have a class to tell them what they're going to face in a parole hearing, so they just don't show up totally unaware of what's going on. And then the parole board will ask, the chairman of the parole board will have an opening statement, will ask questions, and then open it up to parole board members for questions to the individual. And then then we will deliberate as a parole board, then deliberates, makes the decision, and brings the inmate back in the room and gives that decision right then and there, and gives an explanation of that decision, either a denial, a continuation, or a release. And if it's a release or a continuation or a denial, the expectation of the board to the inmate, what they can continue to work on.
And just one more follow-up, if I might.
Representative Story.
Yes, and Mr. Olson, did I say that right? Mr. Larson, sorry. I knew that was
right. That's okay.
Do you find that you make most of your decisions based on how would you say, based on the recommendation of the probation officer or not?
A lot of decisions, yes, are through the chair, are made on the recommendation because the probation parole officer will tell the story through their documentations of the education and the programs they've gone through. It's not all the time true that that will happen, because the other criteria that we have to look at is the severity of the crime and the victim's letters and appeals. But the severity of the crime also comes into effect, and the history of the individual. If an individual comes in front of us with a 20-year extended history of crimes that go over those decades, that has to be also taken into consideration, even though they may have gotten the necessary programs to come in front of us. There's a lot to take in consideration in that period of time. That's why it's a necessity for a parole board member to read the files prior to going into that hearing and to know what's in that file. Just one quick thing. I've read files and thought to myself, wow, this person's probably, you know, not a good candidate. Then when they come in front of us, I've turned my whole thought process around because of the way they present and the sincerity of the individual. And that's another consideration, the sincerity. There's a lot of consideration to for that individual, because we also got to really consider the safety of the community. We don't want these individuals getting out and going right back into violating the law.
Thank you.
Thank you. Additional questions? And for those online, feel free to text me and I can try to air traffic control inbound questions. And I also want the record to reflect that Representative Kaufman and Representative Clayman joined us between 10:10 and 10:15 online.
It's Representative Clayman. I have a couple of questions.
Yeah, Representative Clayman.
So, Mr. Larson, and I, it sounds like you have, you're a new appointment, but you've served on the parole board before.
Sure. I served 2 5-year terms from 2010 to 2020.
And then we're off for a couple of years, and now you're coming, being reappointed back on.
Yeah, through the chair. Yes, sir.
So one of the, I've heard from some constituents and some other folks with concerns that in the last couple of years, and those were times when you weren't serving on the parole board, but there were concerns about the perception that virtually no one was getting granted discretionary parole. And I was curious about your experience with 10 years on the parole board. What is your general sense of how often or infrequent it is that people are actually granted discretionary parole, or do you have a feel for that in terms of that 10 years of experience?
During the 10 years of experience that I had, I believe our average percentage was around 40 to 45%, somewhere in there, of discretionary releases. And some of the ones that weren't given discretionary, we would extend their time and give them certain programs to do, or to, in some cases, to stay disciplinary free, looking at the disciplinary problems that they had, and give them the opportunity to come back and see us. The board has to work. I cannot speak for the last 2 years, but the 10 years I was on the board that I worked with, worked in unison, like I explained, to know that the individual, and let me go back to one other thing. Being in corrections for 29 years and being in a lot of program facilities, we tried our best to make sure that an individual that came into the correctional facility left in a better demeanor than they came in through programs and through work. And that's what we looked at when I was on the full board, what an individual looked like coming in and what they would look like if we released them, the chances that we would take to release them. Like I said, the 10 years we were on, we worked as a board, not to look at an individual as somebody that should not get out, but why they should get out. And so they would explain to us and sell them why they would make themselves a good chance for discretionary parole. And then we would take a look at that and discuss it from there.
Okay. So I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but you would look at it from a standpoint of if they make the case, then they should be granted discretionary parole. If they don't make their case, then they're not going to get granted discretionary parole. But you sounds like you approach it with an open mind. If they make the case, then you're going to be receptive to granting parole, as opposed to sort of everybody that comes in front of you, you should almost never allow discretionary parole. You're pretty open-minded about it, it sounds like.
Yes, correct. Through the chair, correct. The only exceptions are the ones, again, that may have committed such a heinous crime that the there would be such an uproar to release them because of their crime. Those are far and few on the exceptions, and they're usually hideous type of murder. Or a series of murders, or a sex offender that is a repeated sex offender, child molester, that type of thing, then you really have to weigh that. Even though they have done excellent and present themselves well, you have to look at that also. But those are far and few between.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate that reflection and appreciate your answering questions today. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Clayman and Representative Kaufman, Tarr, or Vance. Yes. If you have any questions, go ahead and text me, or you can chime in verbally. Just a quick question, Mr. Larson, from myself. I guess from your experience both working within the correctional system and now having served on the board a couple of terms and potentially for a third term, could you comment or reflect on the relative rate of recidivism and reoffense in Alaska or the country sort of more broadly relative to elsewhere in the world, to the extent that you're familiar with that?
Okay. To the chair, yes, because I still read up on a lot of information, and I'm working with this other organization that also deals in corrections. The major issue that I look at and that I see in the state of Alaska is education. Education is the key. If we can keep our kids in school and offer them not only college track but also career tech opportunities and mix those to the individual. For instance, if I can just reflect on the school board I'm on now, we've changed the criteria for graduation where a child, a student has to have a career tech course to graduate, because our superintendent as well as the studies show that if an individual has career tech as well as college prep, they're more apt to graduate and be successful. So we're so the key figure is to keep them in school, keep them out of drugs. I think the worst possible thing is any kind of drug, including alcohol, that gets an individual hooked. And if they get hooked onto it, the major issue to get them off is programs and the support network. I think the state of Alaska is suffering tremendously through a lot of drug addiction, heroin and fentanyl. They're absolutely the worst possible drug to get into because it hooks people. But I've met a lot of people, and I know some people in our community that have gotten off of it and become successful. But it takes a big support network and the willingness of the individual to do so. Usually when they have productive work as well as support, then they have more tendency to get off of drugs or alcohol. And alcohol is an equal opportunity destroyer. It can destroy people no matter how rich or how poor. It's the same thing with any other drug, including prescription.
And I appreciate that answer, Mr. Larson. I think that, you know, is all very relevant and speaks to relative rates of offense and maybe to some extent to criminalization. But I think what I'm particularly interested in is recidivism and reoffense. So after someone has exited the correctional system, the rates of reoffense when they're released back to society and the extent to which you have sort of observations how Alaska, the United States, is doing more broadly on that level, or the extent to which you've encountered that in your career in corrections.
I think Alaska went through a period of restorative justice that for 2 years that then was reversed back to normal. Because in my opinion, there's about 20% that are incarcerated that need to stay incarcerated. And not only through reading, but through experience. I worked at McLaughlin Youth Center, like I said, in the 70s. And those kids back then were 15, 16, 17. before I got off the board, I was seeing the same individuals that were now in their late 40s and 50s that have spent 40 years or 30 years in and out of prison, no matter how many programs they took. One individual, for instance, had gone through five drug and alcohol treatment programs. And when he came up in front of the parole board, I always, when I ran into a kid that I've known at McLaughlin, I always ask him if it's all right if I stay on the board because I've known him so long. I asked him I told him he could teach the courses, and why are you, you know, coming back again at the age of 53, when I knew him at the age of 16, why are you back in front of us again? And he virtually said, Mr. Larson, I know the right thing to do. But when I get out, I just choose not to do that. And he was, very honest with the board and very open with the board. And individuals like that, you don't want to just lock them away. But you don't want to take a chance on discretionary parole. Now, they can get out on parole, but that's the kind of individual that is telling you, I'm going to commit another crime. I'm going to go back into drugs. And some of these people that come up from the board are very honest people, and they're going to let you know, don't let me out. So there is a percentage that should stay in jail, but it's not a huge, it's maybe 20%. And then there's a middle section that if you get them into programs and you have a support network, their chances of rehabilitation is a lot better. And then there's about 20% that have committed a crime either through passion or through stupidity that will never come back to jail. And Alaska has that criminal justice system set up to assist those three different areas. Whereas other states now have like no bail states, or they're just letting offenders out, and their crime in cities and in their states are going through the ceiling. I believe the state has a good balance and should maintain that balance, in my opinion.
In effect, from your perspective, 20% of the incarcerated population is, to some extent, irredeemable in terms of orientation towards crime. 60% has a potential for rehabilitation, and 20%, it was sort of an aberration, whatever landed them in the correctional system in the first place, and they'll get out and they'll never be back. Is that a semi-fair paraphrasal, I guess, of
yes, it is. But the 20%, you still got to work with. There's still hope, but it's tough when, like I said, when somebody in their 50s come up in front of you and have had 30 or 40 years of incarceration from juvenile hall. Usually the age of 30 to 35 males will virtually look back on their life and say, maybe I've screwed around for 15, 20 years. Maybe I should go straight. There's a reflection or a growth, and we need to be there in the corrections to work with those individuals to get them over the edge and back into society.
Thank you very much, Mr. Larson. Representative Tarr joined us in person from being on the phone at 10:32 as well, for the record. I don't see any other questions. Oh, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's been some really interesting testimony today, and I've appreciated you sharing your perspective, Mr. Larson. And I'm just wondering, because you have that trajectory of having seen people in the juvenile justice system and then in the adult correctional system, if you noticed any trends. We talk a lot about adverse childhood experiences and some of the policies that get kids into the juvenile justice system. I wondered if you ever thought about that and sort of the background and the families that the offenders were coming from.
Thank you. Through the chair, while on the school board and with my own children going through the school system, and now my grandchildren going through the school system, I think the key figure is that our educators, which they are doing, works with those children from homes. At one time, and I haven't seen it for a while, the school system had a paraprofessional course called Working with Children of Incarcerated Parents. And what the course talked about is you don't want to set the child differently, but you want to be aware of that child's condition, and you want to work with that child maybe a little bit more different than a child with a two-parent home professionals, that you could probably give that child a phone book and they would learn, or the child of incarcerated parents or a child with a drug addicted parent may need a little bit more assistance and through education and through care to keep them on board and to keep them going and have them come to school to enjoy school. I think one of the parolees one time talked about he was from the bush, and we asked about safety, and we asked him, did he ever have a safe place to go? Because his parents were both into drugs and his siblings were. And he said, the place that I enjoyed most as a child and my childhood memory was going to school. It was a safe place. I was fed. I was cared for. And, that's where my safe place was as I was growing up. And that's kind of a shame in a way, but it's a reality. So your school system is a very important area, especially when it gets into the seventh and eighth grade, ninth grade, to keep a kid going. The other thing the school districts have done in the past is if a kid drops out of school, to go find out why, to a point, just try to get them back in school and try to get them back into graduating. And some of those type programs, I think, would assist in stopping future kids getting hooked into drugs and alcohol. Because the minute a kid drops out of school, he or she will go find that same crew that's dropped out of school. And then they have all that time on their hand, and then they have all the issues, and they end up incarcerated. And that's what you want to prevent.
Thank you very much, Mr. Larson. I think that concludes questions for the confirmation hearing. Public testimony was noticed today. I don't see anybody online. Is there anybody in the room to testify for Ole Larson, Board of Parole? I don't see anybody. So I think at this point we can entertain it's not really a motion, but a statement of review of Mr. Larson for confirmation. Representative Story.
The State Affairs Committee has reviewed the qualifications of the governor's appointee and recommends that the following name be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. Richard Larson to the State Board of Parole. This does not reflect intent by any of the members to vote for or against these individuals during any further sessions for the purposes of confirmation.
Thank you, Representative Story, and we can circulate the paperwork to those in the room, and that can be forwarded to the full body. That takes us to SB 182, but on the subject of pulpit testimony, I know there are a lot of people here, and based on the t-shirts, a lot of people here for SB 156, although we do have pulpit testimony on this next bill, but I have a guess that there's probably not that many people. Public testimony was not noticed for SB 156, so I just want to be sure that everybody is aware of that, but you're very welcome. We're glad to have you in the committee room for the hearing when it's presented by Ms. Toth. And Senator Reinbold, I thought, actually might be here, but she is online. She's confirmed with me by text, so she'll be here remotely. Speaking of legislators online, we also have Senator Wilson, sponsor of SB 182, online, and then Ms. Jasmine Martin here in the room. Welcome, Ms. Martin. I think the goal here today is offer you and Senator Wilson additional time to present the legislation and then sort of conclude committee questions and answers. And also available for questions, we have Casey Schroeder with the Department of Law Criminal Division, who just joined us in person. Thanks for being here on a Saturday. And online, we have Joel Butcher, the Alaska chapter of NINA and APCO, as well as Jacob Butcher, communications manager for MATCOM Dispatch. And we can dive right in. Ms. Martin or Senator Wilson, any opening comments?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, this is Senator David Wilson. And I think at the table is before you is Ms. Jasmine Martin. I just want to thank the Senate State Affairs Committee, I'm sorry, the House State Affairs Committee for hearing Senate Bill 182 again. Just to give a brief overview, this bill establishes an offense to interface with emergency communications. This statute would only apply when a person repetitively calls 911 to report something that they know has already been reported, repeatedly calls 911 when there's no emergency, harasses or threatens 911 operator, or disrupts communications between 911 operators and first responders. This bill is to give a tool to our first responders to allow our emergency dispatch operators to continually to provide safety and to respond to emergencies in a prompt and efficient manner. We've heard lots of comments upon this bill is not to criminalize mental health. We do a lot in our statutes and within public safety to give every exemption we can. We have therapeutic courts to help folks who may be experiencing mental health situations and need a little bit of assistance to play within our guidelines of our state laws. We allow mental health first aid and other types of trainings to our law enforcement officers so they know how to deal with people that are maybe handling types of crises. We also allow, last session we passed laws to allow folks who may have a hidden disability to display that on their driver's license. So when given ID to law enforcement, they can be more aware of those situations. And we have current legislation pending in the building to allow for mobile crisis response teams and units. This is just a bill to give folks a tool to allow emergency communication operators and dispatchers the opportunity to continually to provide safe and effective tools within their traits and to allow an opportunity to stop this harassing and disruptive behaviors to allow them to continue to do their jobs. And with that, I'll stop and allow for any questions or allow Ms. Martin to correct anything I may have said.
Ms. Martin.
For the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson, I don't necessarily have anything to add to that. That was a great introduction.
Great. Thank you very much, Senator Wilson and Ms. Martin. Any questions from the committee for the sponsors? We also have public testimony, so we can dive into that quickly. But Representative Story, do you have a question?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I'm concerned, as we talked in the first hearing, about that the bill does not mention anyone with dementia issues or developmental disabilities or behavioral health issues who repeatedly calls in. And I'm wondering why there is not a reference to anything of that nature in the bill.
Through the chair, Representative Story, this we believe that there's already exemptions in statutes. We read that sort of last clause in our last committee meeting that talked upon someone has to knowingly call and disrupt. And this, we feel that there's enough tools within the toolboxes of the first, in terms of first responders, of the officers that would contact these individuals, tools within the court system, and tools within the prosecuting attorney's office to make those exceptions when those are case-by-case opportunities. But trying to lay out every single case, that's just a really hard and difficult thing. We just feel that within the current statutes, and I think this morning can probably rephrase those statutes, we feel that those tools are already there to make those exemptions for folks that may be experiencing a mental health situation.
Follow up?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, and maybe someone online today who might have had some seen some experience in how much has this been an issue, and do they feel the protections are in place for individuals who had behavioral health and developmental disabilities conditions?
And there's both of the Mr. Butchers from the MATSU, but Ms. Martin, do you have a sense of which invited testifier might be best for that question too?
For the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson. I believe Jacob Butcher, but there is the Department of Law also online and could provide some perspective?
Or in the room. Although we can call up Ms. Schroeder in a second, but I think if I'm tracking Representative Story's question, Representative Story, you're looking to hear from someone who is dealing with inbound calls. So let's, Mr. Butcher, Jacob Butcher, and myself, you can hear us. Can you go ahead and put yourself on record and speak to Representative Story's question?
Yeah, this is Jacob Butcher, Communications Manager for MACCOM Dispatch in the MATSU. Through the chair to Representative Story, this legislation is by no means geared towards dealing with dementia or behavioral health or mental crisis issues. There are other tools put in place for that, such as CIT response. Hospitalization, the Crisis Now model, as Senator Wilson referenced. This legislation is geared towards those members of the community that choose to knowingly call 911 to either make false reports to simulate a SWAT response, or continually call 911 simply because they're not getting their way or they're upset with the way the system works. As far as the frequency of dealing with these things, it is not a very frequent issue. However, it does rear its head at least a couple times per year with our PSAP, and we're only one of numerous across the state. So I can imagine that if we're dealing with 3 to 4 per year, a larger center such as APD or AFB in Anchorage would be feeling a higher volume of those types of calls. It's not just the vulgar, harassing, and belittling behavior by certain members of the community when told to stop, but also the false reports and false audio that gets made. We dealt with one as recently as this month where it was simulation of sounds of a police radio, followed by sounds of gunfire, followed by sounds of a struggle between an officer and a person. Those types of calls are gut-wrenching. They bring the entire system to a halt because all the resources are dedicated to finding that first responder that may be in a gun battle somewhere, only to find out that it's a false call. So, finding a dispatcher that doesn't understand dementia or behavioral or mental health crisis, to the extent where they want to push the law enforcement officers on duty to file charges, I think it would be very difficult to find that in the first step, but then to find a law enforcement officer that as well doesn't understand dementia, behavioral or mental health crisis to press those charges. And then a third layer to have a district attorney that actually goes after a felony or high misdemeanor charge for somebody who's not mentally fit to understand those charges. I think between those three layers, there is a good system already in place, as Senator Wilson was already referencing.
Thank you. Follow-up perhaps for the Department of Law?
Yeah, Representative Story.
I'm just wanting to know if they feel protections are in place and this bill needs to be strengthened in that area, or if there's protections in law in other places.
For the record, Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General with the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. Through the chair to Representative Story, I tend to agree in general with what Mr. Butcher has articulated to you. I can't speak for exactly what happens on the ground when law enforcement encounters this kind of thing. I can only speak to when we would actually get referred a case. If we were actually referred a case and there was some indication that somebody had some sort of diminished capacity, mental illness, or was suffering from some sort of other disease, we would look at whether or not the person was even able to formulate the mental state. And that is what Senator Wilson has referred to, whether or not they were able to act knowingly. Then we would look at whether or not the person was able to even appreciate the nature of their conduct. And so that would be one analysis. The other thing we would look at is whether or not the person is competent to stand trial. So they have to be able to assist their defense attorney with their defense. And those are two different analyses. And those are conversations that happen with the prosecutor and the defense attorney to see whether or not the system really needs to be involved or if this needs to be resolved in a different way. If we cross all those hurdles and we'd look at, okay, so now we have a clean case, we have somebody who does meet the mental state, who was acting knowingly, then we would look at whether or not prosecution in this case for this individual is appropriate. Is prosecution or a criminal sanction in the best interest of justice in this case? And then that's a separate analysis that happens apart from whether or not the person has some sort of diminished capacity. So yes, I believe there is protections in place.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schroeder. And so in the previous hearing, were you listening or did you have the opportunity to review audio of the previous hearing?
Mr. Chairman, I was not listening close enough and I have not a chance to review.
I gave the example, real world example of my grandmother who had dementia and would call 911 incessantly and forget and sort of be in a removed from reality state as she would because she was genuinely scared and alone in her house. Can you walk me through, I mean, I think this is just sort of applying what you just described in the abstract to a specific example, how if my grandmother lived in Alaska and were placing those calls incessantly to 911, let's just say there was the most gung-ho, champion at the bit prosecutor in the world that wanted to prosecute that, you know, objectively annoying and sort of gumming up the system series of phone calls. What would the barriers be for that champion at the bit prosecutor from prosecuting that behavior?
Mr. Chairman, based on the hypothetical you've given me, it appears as though you said that she was removed from reality. It sounds like she was probably not able to appreciate the nature of her conduct. And there are legal barriers then to that. The other question would be whether or not she was even competent to stand trial. And those analyses are not mutually exclusive. So we would first be asking if she was competent to stand trial. And that is a long process. The judge is involved. There are medical professionals involved in all of these analyses. The prosecutor is not qualified to make that determination. Professional said, well, yeah, she's competent to stand trial. She may have not known what was happening then, but she knows what's happening now and she can stand trial. So then we would look at, okay, so what was the mental capacity then? And there are defenses that her attorney could run that have to do with mental illness and whether or not she was able to formulate the intent at the time of the incident. So
on that second analysis, her intent very clearly was to call 911. That's exactly what she wanted to do. In fact, that's the problem. So if the intent is present, maybe the intent is sort of removed from like a real world context of reality, but the intent was present. I mean, she was very knowingly wanting to call 911. That was the problem. It's kind of a circular thing I'm getting at, but we need people to speak to that.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, there are a couple of defenses that can be run. I think what you may be describing is more closer to, so you're assuming that she was able to formulate the mental state. So she knowingly called 911 repeatedly. Then we would look at whether or not she was able to appreciate the nature and quality of the conduct. And then that's a defense that could be run. by her attorney, and obviously they would be bringing in experts to testify to that and all that stuff. But I do want to say that we are really talking in hypothetical land here. We're talking about an A misdemeanor, and in your hypothetical, this is somebody who's elderly and is probably diagnosed with something. I just don't see a lot of prosecutors just really wanting to, you know, thinking that a criminal sanction in those cases is appropriate.
Yeah, I appreciate that. At the same time, you know, if that's clearly not the intent, I don't think the law should be criminalizing that behavior and just sort of when relying on sort of discretion application. I mean, it's just likely to, if we all agree that that doesn't make sense, that the law doesn't criminalize that kind of behavior.
So, Mr. Chairman, the defenses I'm describing are in statute, and they're in 1247.010 and 1247.020, and those are defenses that her attorney can run.
Okay. Speaking of A misdemeanor or C felony, can you refer for the committee what the sentencing ranges are for those two classes of crime?
Mr. Chairman, an A misdemeanor is has a sentencing range from 0 to 1 year, and a Class C felony has a sentencing range from 0 up to 5 years as a max. The presumptive range for a first C felony would be 0 to 2 years.
Okay. Thank you. Are there fines associated with Class A misdemeanors and C felonies?
There are, Mr. Chairman.
What are those fines?
Chair Christ Duncan?
Yes, Representative Story.
Well, that's been looked up. I kind of have a follow-up to that as far as when that call is made, what is the response and what will immediately happen to that person? Are they arrested at that time? Just wanting to know. I'm curious about that.
Absolutely.
Mr. Chairman, as to the fines, it's a maximum of $25,000 for a Class A misdemeanor and a maximum of $50,000 for a Class C felony.
Okay, thank you. I may want to engage with the sponsor. I get the badness, for lack of a better word, of what we're talking about, but also sort of want to think about proportionateness of penalty and sanction. And I don't take felony lightly. And, 0 to 2 years in prison or a $50,000 fine is... not late, but Representative Eastman, you're in the queue.
Thank you. And just to follow up through that, and isn't there a provision for if an organization is found liable for a larger fine to be assessed?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, yes. Yes, there is.
And what's the amount that can be assessed at the max?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, for an organization, it would be a maximum of $500,000 for a Class A misdemeanor. And it's a maximum of $2.5 million for a felony offense.
Thank you.
That results in death. I apologize if that results in death.
Representative Eastman.
I'm just curious. So currently, is it against the law to knowingly submit a fraudulent report to law enforcement or an emergency dispatcher?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, there is a crime called making a false report. Some of that conduct could fall under that statute.
Thank you. And is it currently a crime to knowingly harass an emergency dispatcher?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, not specifically as you have articulated it. There is harassment in the second degree, and some of the elements of that offense talk about repeatedly making phone calls at inconvenient hours. So I think what you have is with this statute is, yeah, there are statutes that cover some of this conduct, but this one is directly on point and wouldn't fill in any gaps that occur in current law.
Follow up. And is it currently a crime to knowingly threaten an emergency communications worker?
So the chair, Representative Eastman, that it depends on what it is. It could fall under some statutes, yes.
Follow up. Well, I know there are statutes against threatening people, Is there an exception for emergency communications workers so that you wouldn't commit that crime if you were doing it against a communications worker?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, there is no exemption based on the employment, but it does depend on what the communication is. There is a element of harassment that talks about making phone calls that threaten physical injury or sexual contact, so that the type of threat is specific in that statute.
Thank you.
Representative Klayman online has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think there's your, we can start with Ms. Schroeder, and if somebody else needs to join in, then that'd be great. It seems like the questions that the chair is raising about a person that is suffering from, an elderly person suffering from dementia that is intentionally calling 911 or knowingly calling 911, but for various reasons. I think there's a notion that the fact there are defenses available kind of doesn't address, I think, what is the larger topic, which is somebody in that situation, it seems, shouldn't be getting charged at all, because, you know, the notion of what does a family go through and what does the person go through with dementia, I guess I may not necessarily remember what's happening from one day to the next, but the notion of that somebody has, who's been making repeated calls but suffering that kind of mental illness is then being started through the criminal justice system seems to be, that to me is quite challenging, because I understand the problem of repeated calls, but I also understand with somebody in that situation going, even having to get lawyers and go through the whole system is not going to make their condition any better. And how do we deal with that?
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, I think that goes back to what Mr. Butcher said and what I started out saying. First, the prosecutor would have to even be referred a case. And there has already been testimony that law enforcement receives training on how to deal with people with mental illnesses or diminished capacity. And there are other ways besides referring a criminal case to deal with that. If the case were referred for some reason, those are exactly the things the prosecutor is looking at. If there's some sort of indication in the report that the person has some sort of mental issue, we're going to be looking at, how old is this person? What do we think this might be? Do we need to really pursue this case? Are there other ways to do that? Are we even going to be able to meet the mental state? You know, and do we want to expend those resources trying to find it out, given the level of the offense and that nobody was hurt? You know, we're always looking at the facts, obviously, and there are levels, there's a range of conduct we're talking about here. But in the situation that Representative Christ Tompkins is talking about, that's the type of analysis that the prosecutor is going to look at. How old is this person with their criminal history? Why did this land on my desk in the first place? Is there a reason why it was referred as a criminal case and not resolved in another way? And so the prosecutor is going to look at that and decide whether or not this is the appropriate resolution or the right thing to do for this case, for this person, in the interest of justice.
Okay. And then, again, somewhat similar, I think another one of the challenges about these repeated calls, I remember from my early days training as an emergency medical technician that there were some paramedics that were training us, and they were describing scenarios in which they'd get 911 calls, and he actually described a particular an elderly woman who did not suffer from dementia but was really just lonely, and about, you know, 2 to 3 times a month they would get a call that she was having some kind of a medical emergency, and the paramedics would go. And this was actually somebody that did have, it wasn't without potential that there were potential medical issues that she could be calling about. But most of the time they would just call and she'd just be waiting for them and happy to see them and pleased to see a bunch of firefighters and medic or paramedics in uniform. And they would check around and make sure there was no problem, and then they'd go. And again, that seems like the sort of case in which, even if you didn't have dementia in play, I would hope that kind of case wouldn't result in prosecution, even though this is somebody that repeatedly calls. It doesn't seem like the intent to interrupt the system is present there, although probably inappropriate calls at some level. I mean, how does that get dealt with if this if this bill becomes law? Do they call her up and say, stop calling us because you never call when you're having an emergency?
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Butcher?
Senator Wilson.
Yes. Senator Wilson, I can't tell the voice.
Oh, yeah, thank you. For the record, this is Senator David Wilson. Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think the issue that I think we're trying to get to is how do we get folks help? I mean, if there's no intervention, then those same individuals would continue to call and continue to call. But with this would give a tool, and I said again, with combined with a couple of other statutes and ongoing items, that this will give a probable cause for a law officer to be able to call a mobile crisis response unit that may be able to give more assistance so that we can get to the root of the problem, so that we can help mitigate these ongoing future causes to not to have criminal behavior, but to be able to find the appropriate help and their appropriate response. But without a real clear statute, then this behavior will continue and we're not giving the tools necessary to help stop and to help intervene these type of behaviors. So that's really the intent of the bill, is we're not trying to criminalize the behavior other than those individuals who send out those false reports like swatting calls, trying to get people to get injured or to intentionally disrupt this behavior. But the cases I think we're talking about, this will give them the tools necessary to be able to respond to that help, and to be able to get a first responder or be able to notify the family or to be able to get a little bit more intervention that law officers would not have a necessary time to do, but maybe having those crisis interventions and those behavioral health specialists be able to respond to those individuals would give them the better tools so that they can seek that help and so that we can get them on a better path to be more productive citizens.
Representative Clayman, any follow-up?
A couple of other follow-ups. I appreciate that answer. I think the next question is for Mr. Butcher. He described what I would describe as a fairly elaborate effort to kind of create a scenario on the phone that sounds like a real emergency that took more than just sort of somebody calling up repeatedly, but somebody actually getting sounds and getting noises and getting somebody else on the phone screaming or all the details, but how frequently are people actually calling with really, for lack of a better description, really a fraudulent call where they're trying to create the impression there's a real-life emergency when, in fact, there's not?
Mr. Butcher.
Thank you. I appreciate that question. And through the chair to Representative Clayman, those calls are much less frequent and are usually not that elaborate, really, with technology the way that it is nowadays. These are becoming more and more of an issue with 911 and can be dealt with to some extent on federal regulation for communication lines and things like that. That is part of it, not to say that it couldn't happen locally, because during the same weekend we were getting spoofed calls like that from a local Alaska number, which ended up being traced through the technical crimes unit to another state or another country. What I really, really want to impress here is the language in there, that it's not just because somebody calls 911 repeatedly, or not because somebody calls 911 a certain number of times in a month for a medical response or a police response. This is really geared towards those people that are calling 911 knowing that there's not an emergency or knowing that there's not a change after being told to stop. So what this would look like real life, because 911 dispatchers deal with frequent callers on a daily basis and elderly people that are suffering from medical diagnosis like dementia or other things like that, we take care with those callers because we understand what's going on, as do most law enforcement officers. What this is geared towards is people that are upset with law enforcement or other first response, and they're calling intentionally to create a kink in the communication chain and tie up the line. I mean, we've got audio of 85 calls that were placed over a day where the individual was calling strictly to yell, cuss, and complain about the service that he was provided. Now, from a personal experience of the harassment charges and threats and things like that, one example that I personally dealt with back in 2009 was over 100 911 calls that were extremely vulgar and profane to the other female dispatchers in the room. there was charges pressed against that individual. However, those charges for harassment were dropped. There were several other examples through 2013 to 2014 that I dealt with personally where there was 36 911 calls within a 3-hour span from the same individual. Now, to file a harassment charge on these individuals, I, as an emergency dispatcher, have to step out of my role as an emergency dispatcher, put on my citizen hat, and file a misdemeanor committed outside the presence of a law enforcement officer complaint, which can then be pressed as me as a citizen pressing a charge against another individual that's a citizen. There is no tool in place right now for emergency communication workers to have their organization referenced as a harassment or a threat.
Thank you, Mr. Butcher. And I'm just watching the time. Maybe a final follow-up, Representative Clayman.
Sure. How does this proposed crime on the misdemeanor level then differ from harassment on the misdemeanor? Well, harassment is misdemeanor. How do those two differ in terms of the dispatcher or the supervisor having to step outside their role as a dispatcher and fill in an affidavit because the conduct occurred outside the presence of an officer? How do these differ at the misdemeanor level?
And Mr. Butcher, feel free to take a pass at that, or Ms. Martin or Ms. Schroeder as well.
Yeah, absolutely. This is Jacob Butcher, Communications Manager for MATCOM, through the chair to Representative Clayman. This would give law enforcement the tools, because all 911 calls, radio lines coming in and out of the dispatch center are recorded. This gives the opportunity for the dispatchers to try to handle it at their seat, saying, stop calling us on 911 unless you have a new or different emergency. After the way this would actually play out in real life is the dispatcher would tell the caller that if they continue to call, it would be passed to a law enforcement officer, which could then review the audio, review the circumstances, and normally what would happen is the law enforcement officer would make contact with the individual over the phone and tell them from a law enforcement stance, you need to stop calling or you're going to be charged criminally. If it continues after that point, you've been given your warning and you're continuing the conduct, and then the law enforcement officer can go out there and make the arrest. As an organization, an emergency communications organization, the law enforcement officer can file that charge for violating the statute against the communication organization, as opposed to the individual dispatcher having to fill out a complaint form with all of their personal information and give it to this person who's already upset with them.
And just a brief, I take it they're relying on the recording that makes it possible for the officer to file the charges without needing the dispatcher to personally declare something.
The recordings would be an extra boost for the case if it came down to an arrest. The communication center or the communication officer would be the one to give their statement and more than likely hand over the recordings, which would just be further evidence for the case.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Clayman and Mr. Butcher. Before we go to public testimony, we're just kind of staying on the time budget, 10:45 to 11:15, but Representative Eastman, how do you in the queue, and then we'll move on.
Thank you, appreciate that. And I didn't say anything the first time this bill is before the committee, but I feel a need to now. I can't see this bill as redeemable, frankly, and I don't say that lightly about very many bills. But as someone who has worked in emergency services, is a certified firefighter, EMT, et cetera, I'm thinking of all the situations where we have, you know, what we call frequent flyers, you know, where some elderly person, you know, really wants to see a certain paramedic and they make a call, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, this is just part of the way the system works. I'm thinking back to, you know, the forest fire we had in the last legislature. We lost 53 structures in my district. And you have, you know, firefighters trying to prioritize what buildings, what houses they're going to save. And you've got homeowners saying, hey, you know, come save my house. And we're telling, you know, them, you know, hey, if we say stop, you know, bothering us, then we're not going to make it a crime for them to come back to us and say, hey, you know, come help save my house. And at the moment that we do that, we're now encouraging people to not try and get on the priority list for us. We're encouraging them to go back to their house and try and save their house and potentially get killed in a forest fire. I think if this bill does become law, it will the very first time you get a call of someone whose daughter or friend or whatever, you know, ended up dying after they stopped calling, you know, the police to try and help them, the law will be repealed because it'll be such an outcry. I mean, we already know these things are happening now without the law in place, because I have people calling me, you know, asking me to call APD or some law enforcement because their, you know, daughter or friend is being sex trafficked and law enforcement isn't doing enough about it. You know, those calls are coming in and law enforcement gets to prioritize those. And if we're telling them to stop calling, we don't get to call it anymore to make a decision, yes, no, or otherwise, about what's to be done. So the third part I would just say is, if we have harassment laws that are not adequate, that are not strong enough, then let's fix those. If we have threatening, you know, laws against threatening people that aren't strong enough, let's fix those. But to try and make, you know, emergency personnel sort of a, you know, first tier citizens and everyone else second tier because we're being harassed or we're being threatened or, you know, whatnot, I just think that's a really bad way for society to go. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kleeman, or Representative Eastman, forgive me. We're going to open public testimony at this time, and I see two in the queue for public testimony online, although I just first want to ask, is anybody here in person to testify on SB 182? I don't see anybody, so we'll go to Hillary Palmer in Wasilla. If you can hear us, please go ahead, put yourself on record, and present your testimony in two or fewer minutes.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Hillary Palmer. And thank you to the House State Affairs Committee for your service to our state and for this opportunity to testify on behalf of SB 182, sponsored by Senator Wilson, which, as you've heard, seeks to prohibit interference with emergency services. I'm here today as your constituent from the MATSU and as someone who has relied upon emergency medical services to bring my type 1 diabetic husband back to me so many times when he was in kidney failure before his life-saving transplant surgery. So what does it mean to prohibit interference with emergency services? As you've heard today, occasionally someone who is experiencing a mental health or substance abuse crisis will call 911 repeatedly with the intent to harass or prank dispatchers. We're talking about a call volume from that individual that often exceeds 50 to 100 calls in a 24-hour period. And this occurs before they either fall asleep or find something else to do. But it ties up the phone lines, and it requires dispatchers to place calls for actual emergencies on hold. So why can't dispatchers simply look at that caller ID and ignore those repeated calls? Well, in most dispatch centers, the 911 call takers are required to answer all incoming 911 calls within 3 seconds. So that means even if they see the caller ID and they know the caller is merely just going to harass them again, they still have to answer that phone. Currently, you or I as citizens have more rights and abilities to stop this kind of harassment than our 911 operators, who are busy trying to save lives. To step outside their dispatcher role and file a harassment charge, the dispatcher fills out a form giving their personal information as a complainant, which can then lead to personal attacks and stalking. Please take a moment to imagine yourself in a situation where someone you love is having a severe medical emergency and you have called 911 for help. As the dispatcher is talking you through how to provide care until first responders arrive, let's say they're coaching you through CPR, they may sometimes need to place you on a brief hold in order to communicate with responders. But what if, in your time of need, someone who is not having an emergency decides to prank call 911 every 5 minutes for 24 hours? When seconds count and lives are at stake, we can't afford to cater to this kind of dangerous attention-seeking behavior. We just need a way to keep this person away from their phone.
A bit over 2 minutes, so if you can summarize your testimony, we'd be grateful.
We're just asking for you to help ensure dispatchers can do their job so they can be the calm voice in your moment of chaos. Please support this bill so that Alaskans will never have to wonder if the outcome for their loved one would have been different if only 911 professionals were free to perform to the best of their abilities. Thank you.
Thank you very much for taking the time to testify. And next in the queue, we have Mark Pearson in Soldotna. if you can hear us, please go ahead, put yourself on record, and present your testimony.
This is Mark Pearson. I'm president of the Alaska Peace Officers Association. I represent 800 members in our association of law enforcement officers and other members of the law enforcement community throughout our state. We would recommend supporting this bill as it addresses the issue of dispatchers having repeated harassment phone calls that can only be dealt through harassment or other statutes that don't directly address the issue that this bill will address. As Representative Eastman mentioned, you know, the other alternative fixes that aren't to fix, this is why SB 182 is needed to address that loophole that 911 operators can, with limited staffing and overwhelming calls, take care of those that need to be taken care of in a timely emergency situation and address those that want to make repeated harassing phone calls, taking away time from those in time of need and address what needs to be taken care of appropriately as this bill will address. And we support it as APOA members and would encourage you to pass this legislation to eliminate that loophole and strengthen our 911 workers in their job that they have.
Thank you very much, Mr. Pearson, for your testimony. And I don't see anybody else online, so we'll set aside SB 182 for further consideration. Thank you very much, Ms. Martin, Ms. Schroeder, for being here, and Senator Wilson for being online and presenting the legislation. We're slipping a little bit off the 30-minute per bill pace, so and I'm going to close public testimony for SB 182. For HB 316, we have Representative Kaufman online, and I'm going to take a brief at ease to see if Staff to Rep Kaufman, Matt Harvey, is nearby. Going back on the record, welcome, Mr. Harvey, and we have HB 316, and we have a committee substitute for HB 316. So maybe what we can do is entertain a motion, and before taking action on that motion, hear about the CS. So Representative Clayman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move to adopt the committee substitute for House Bill 316, version B, as our working document.
I'll object for purposes of presentation. Mr. Harvey or Representative Kaufman, please proceed with the overview of the CS.
This is Representative Kaufman for the record, and I want to thank you all for hearing the CS. We had the bill as it had originally come back to us was too strident in what it was asking for. In that it would have created a tracking system to track everything, and that was never our intent. And by doing the CS, we were able to pare it back to our actual intent, which was to track only the higher criticality type action items that would be beneficial in an organization. So for that reason, we requested the CS, and so it has been reduced back. And I've had some connectivity problems where I'm at. Is Matthew Harvey in the room?
He is. He's sitting at the table in front of the committee.
Okay, great. So I'll hand it over to him at this point, and hopefully the call won't drop again. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kaufman. Mr. Harvey.
Thank you. For the record, Matthew Harvey, staff to Representative Kaufman. And I can just go over like the high level main changes. There's a few, you know, I kind of split it out by page and line with all the specific changes. But the main changes are really, as Representative Kaufman said, to prioritize the critical few improvement items and progress only these. So that the language is not requiring to progress every item. Some may not be beneficial or have a return that is worth progressing. And then condense the tracking requirements for improvement items. So for all improvement items, there will be really reduced requirements. And then for the critical few improvement items that you're going to progress, there is a condensation of some of those to not be as prescriptive. Then there's also a publicize an annual report regarding use of the system. So if you're progressing some of the critical few, then there's a requirement to show which of those you're progressing and how you're doing on the progress of those items, and then some cleanup language throughout throughout the bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Harvey. Questions from the committee on the CS? And anybody online, Representative Klayman or Representative Vance? Hearing none, I will remove my objection to adoption of version B as the working document. Is there any further objection to the motion to adopt version B for HB 316 as the committee substitute? Seeing and hearing none, version B is adopted as the working document in the committee. And with that on the record, I'm not sure if that little group is somebody looking to get in the queue, but so go ahead.
I'm sorry, this is Representative Kaufman. Could you please repeat that last bit?
Oh, I wasn't sure, Rep. Kaufman, if that was a member, Representative Klayman, or Representative Vance with a question, but it sounds like it was not. All right. Okay. Well, hearing no questions.
If I could comment.
Yes, please do, Rep. Kaufman.
Thank you. And I'm sorry I had to call in for this. It was unavoidable. But we received the fiscal note on this, and what we believe happened is that they did it to the original document as written, which wasn't what we wanted. So it has quite a significant fiscal note. And so we'll work on getting that updated. We believe either through misunderstanding or perhaps referencing the previous bill for the fiscal note that we ended up with the indeterminate fiscal note that we have. But the scope it describes is beyond what we were hoping to have.
Thank you. And has there been any dialogue with the executive branch about the relative order of magnitude of what a fiscal note for the CS might be?
For the record, Matthew Harvey. Yes, we met with OMB previously, and that was before we had the CS back. And so there was a discussion about what the CS was going to look like, but it wasn't really concrete what the CS was going to look like. So it was a little bit difficult to talk about the specific language that was requested. So we had that meeting initially, and I now that we have the CS back, I think it's worth doing again.
Okay. I think that would be of interest to me, at least. And has there been any engagement with the University of Alaska, seeing their inclusion in the state agency definition on page 3, line 22?
For the record,
this is
Matthew
Representative.
Representative Kaufman.
I'll hand it to Matthew in a second, but we had previously met with the university chancellor and had discussed in general improvement processes. So it sounds like part of their overall move to, into a continuous improvement process. Like this is something, in my sense of it, if they're doing it on the scale of what they've been discussing, they'll have something like this in play. And to you, Matthew, thank you.
I think that kind of sums up what I was going to say, but, basically, they are doing this already, and there's some, like the university is a good example of people who and that already have something like this in place where it's kind of like a plug and play, where it's just putting it into a standardized format that can be managed across all the agencies. So they're kind of a little bit ahead of the curve of some agencies. But to what Representative Kaufman said, we had talked generally about it with them previously.
Are there any other states with such a tracking system?
To the chair, the Washington has a group that's kind of like a project management office for improvement projects, which is much more than we would like to do. And then probably the best example is the GAO at federal level, which again is built out more than we would like to see, but it has on GAO.gov, there's an action tracker that tracks audit findings and findings based on other reports and publications. They do a lot more at the federal level. But it's an online, easy to access database that it's easy to use and see, and that tracks actions similar to this.
Thank you. And I think the last question I've got is, in terms of higher criticality, can you just kind of unpack what at least the intent of higher criticality would be, or maybe some real state of Alaska examples of perceived higher criticality issues?
Yeah, to the chair, I guess an example might be Representative Kaufman sits on Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, and there was a thing that we did this year because we saw the accrual of audit findings basically tripling in the last 10 years, and in order to like come up with a way to work those off, we worked with Chris Curtis, the legislative auditor, and the legislative budget and audit chair, and the rest of the committee, to identify the top 10, as we called it, the top 10 audit findings that could be worked off. And there was, based on how long they were sitting around, the cost impacts, or the size of the audit finding, and then a few other factors, and came up with the top 10. The first, and we focused on those. We sent letters out to each department asking for clarification on what actions were being completed with regards to those audit findings. Some of them are difference in opinion based on between the auditor and the executive branch, and that's okay. You just define that and set out what a possible action set could be, and then once those are defined, you can agree to move on some of those actions. But on the other ones, the clarification of those actions and kind of raising up the level of those top 10, we've cleared off 9 of the 10. The one that is still on there is a difference of opinion that needs to be worked out separately in a different way. But that was kind of an example of a way to I guess I wouldn't say quantitatively, it was a mixture of quantitative and qualitative ranking of the top 10. But that was an example of like prioritizing a critical few and taking action based on those critical few and trying to clear some off.
Thank you. I mean, it occurs to me that the real focus here would be agencies, and that's where 90-95% plus of the action is. And I guess I'll just maybe make that more as like a comment. But I mean, I think the legislative auditor review process on boards and commissions is strikes me as sort of like a very small portion overall. But thinking about how this would apply to agencies is where the meat and potatoes are. But any further questions from the committee? Seeing none, Representative Klayman and Vance online, if you have any questions, go in once, twice, thrice, and gone. Representative Kaufman, any closing comments?
This is Representative Kaufman. Thank you, through the chair. I just want to thank everyone for hearing this. The intent behind this is to start to try and create some of the utilities that enable organizations to improve. I think of the state of Alaska as a multi-billion dollar operation that could use a few more quality management processes, and the ability to do a criticality ranking of improvement needs and start to track them, to a point of closure is just a very rudimentary process that I think could, if implemented, could reap big rewards. So I want to thank everybody for considering this idea, and I look forward to discussing it further. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kaufman. And I'm going to set an amendment deadline for HB 316 that parallels the amendment deadline for SB 161, which is restated at the beginning of the hearing. So that's submission of legislative legal Tuesday at 5 p.m. and submission to my office Wednesday at 5 p.m. Thank you, Representative Kaufman and Mr. Harvey. And we'll set HB 316 aside for further consideration. We just clawed back a little bit of time on our time budget. But that takes us to the third item on today's agenda, HB 256 from Representative Tarr, relating to law enforcement registry use of force. Take a brief at ease and get ready for the presentation. Going back on the record, welcome Representative Tarr, albeit in a little bit different seat and situation. This is a first hearing for House Bill 256, and Representative Tarr, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and colleagues, for the opportunity to present House Bill 256. I think David Song may be joining us by phone, and so he may offer some comments as we go through the presentation today. Appreciate the opportunity to bring this bill before you. Want to start by thanking our public safety professionals that keep us safe every day. And just acknowledge that, you know, we understand what a hard job they have, and just trying to meet the, you know, evolving requirements and expectations and demands of those positions. House Bill 256 is part of a seven-part package. This committee has previously heard one of the other bills that are part of this package from Senator Gray Jackson, Senate Bill 7. Our companion for that was House Bill 255. So this is House Bill 256 is another companion to this seven-part package that Senator Gray had put in last year. And then we were working with her, sort of tracking the progress on those pieces of legislation and following, you know, the conversation she was having with Alaskans and then folks in the public safety community. And you'll see, you know, some of the letters of support, for example, are addressed to her and, you know, reflect that we've been collaborating on these pieces of legislation. And so this seven-part package, they call Turning Pain into Progress, and it represents, you know, the reflection on some of the things that have happened and, you know, sort of accountability to the public. And trying to strike that balance between providing a lot of support for our public safety professionals, knowing what a hard job they have, and at the same time meeting the expectations about accountability that the public has. For this specific piece of legislation, it does a handful of things. And so this one is really aimed at the use of force reporting. And so there's a few sections that are related to that. One is the part that gives the Alaska Police Standards Council the authority to develop some regulations around use of force reporting, and then also directs the council to maintain a registry of all police officers, probation officers, parole officers, municipal correctional officers, and correctional officers who've had a certificate denied or revoked. This, as I understand it, is largely the practice anyhow, but, you know, this would sort of codify that practice and put it in statute. Also, questions that came up around, you know, do we do the same kind of thing if there's someone trying to make a lateral transfer or into Alaska transfer for the same reasons that we might want to have it? And yes, you know, they do look into that. And then the part about the report are the last parts of that section. And then you'll see when we go down to sections 5, 6, and 7, those really relate to the use of force reporting, whether it be from the municipality and requiring that they would report to the FBI or the Department of Public Safety that they would report to the FBI the, you know, each incident in which force has been used. And then you'll notice the Section 8 has the statewide use of force report. And so what that would be is a compilation of that information that would be provided to policymakers. The other parts of the bill really deal with training of municipal correctional employees. And so that's really Sections 2, 3, and 4. And so what this bill does, you'll notice in Section 2, is it changes from being something that's permissive on the part of the municipality. So you'll see the existing language says a municipality that employs a person in a municipal correctional facility may by ordinance require that those persons meet the requirements. And those are the training requirements from the Alaska Police Standards Council. What this bill does is change that from being a local authority to making it a requirement that all of those municipal correctional officers participate in that training. The good news about that, and it's reflected in the fiscal notes, is that there's capacity to offer that. And you know, like we find out in bills that we work on sometimes, a lot of what is being mandated or, you know, made official through this legislation is already done in practice. And so, for example, many of the municipalities are already sending their municipal correctional officers through this training. But for the ones that aren't, they do have capacity to offer that. So it doesn't require, you know, any fiscal impact to, you know, host another academy, for example. But what we did to be responsive to making that part work is if you look at Section 11, where it talks about the transition. And this would be on the Section 11, I believe it should be line 11, where it says has 2 years from the effective date of Section 9 of this bill. So the requirement for all of those municipal correctional employees to have completed that training is the requirement has been changed to be for 2 years. And so that way, you know, given the existing capacity that exists in the training academies, you know, those folks through that, having that 2-year opportunity, will definitely be able to cycle through, make sure we don't miss anyone. And again, it's not the intent, right, to sort of make anyone in violation of the law. The intent here is that it's been shown, you know, through the research that it can be more effective policing and safer for both the public safety of professionals and the public when people have a little bit more training. And so that's what we'll accomplish through that requirement. In terms of the use of force reporting, again, also a lot of that already happening among the public safety professionals across Alaska. And I believe you should have in your packet a list of all of them that are already participating. And if it's not in your packet, it's in mine. And I apologize if it's not. We can get that list to you. But it turns out that most of them are already participating in the use of force reporting. And so, you know, it would just be a handful that we need to cycle into this to, you know, bring everybody up to speed. And really the reason that they might not be doing it currently is that this whole FBI use of force reporting is a pretty new system. And so, you know, they have been working on a nationwide basis to try and get law enforcement agencies to participate. And it's been voluntary so far. And so, you know, what we're doing, again, is just we would be making it mandatory. Now, in terms of, you know, how this works, and I'm definitely not speaking as the expert here, but what I've learned by working with our DPS and DOC folks and the folks that do the data, you know, for the agencies that are already reporting, I believe it's in the last calendar year, we had 13 incidents to report. And so, you know, it's an infrequent occurrence that the use of force meets the FBI definition. And I believe that handout is in your documents, or I know we submitted that handout to be part of the bill packet. So you can, you know, if you're interested, take a look and get a little more clarity on that. But, you know, what we have in terms of who's already doing it, you know, looks like infrequent occurrence, but, you know, they're trying to collect the data to understand better the circumstances of what happens when use of, you know, when there is use of force. And of course, people are probably familiar that in law enforcement and in corrections, and in fact, in our, you know, in our own Department of Corrections, there has been a big movement towards de-escalation training, right, for the safety of both the, you know, the officers and the civilians or the inmates. So it's not inconsistent, you know, with what is sort of the movement in public safety, right, for improving it for everyone. So what we think could come out of this, you know, now that the FBI is doing this is, you know, typically they start with collecting the data and then, you know, by participating, often funding is made available for additional training. That could be something that's positive for the state. But the incidents that are reported, you know, what happens at the sort of department level is the officer, you know, fills out an incident report, right, because they're going to do that to file charges and, you know, that information is going to be available. Then, as I understand it, the administrative staff person is who then, you know, forwards that piece of information and the items, the demographic information that the FBI wants. And so we're not taking time away from officers being on the street to provide services. You know, they would function in the same way that they do now. And then, you know, it's the administrative staff person that would then, send that information off.
Thank you, Representative Tarr. Questions from the committee for the sponsor? Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Christ Tompkins. Through the chair, Rep Tarr. Thank you for trying to help Alaska become more a part of what I believe was set up in 2019 from the FBI to give different public safety information if there was an officer who was denied or let go from their force for excessive use of force and transferred to another one. There is a database that would be to apply for another peace officer position, that there is a database available to them. And what I've heard you say is that many of our systems in Alaska are set up to do this. Some are doing it, but this would have all of those shall have to participate in that. And so our smaller public safety officers, what have their comments been on this requirement?
Through the chair to Representative Story, we haven't had anyone specifically reach out. You know, the conversation around that was more related to, you know, what would it look like to implement this? And so, you know, I don't know if Kelly from DPS might have something additional and, you know, might maybe able to share a little bit more. But a lot of the conversation was around, you know, what information is already required to be, gathered from each incident, and then, you know, does that information basically mirror the information? And the answer is yes. You know, they're through their standard practice of the kind of information they would need to file their incident reports, it's gonna, you know, be the information that needs to go then to the FBI. Without having everybody implemented, the best way I can answer the question is saying, you know, knowing that there were 13 reportable incidents through the 80% of officers that are already participating. So all of the large agencies in Alaska are participating already. So, you know, capturing that last 20%, it is in the smaller agencies. So it was a concern. But, you know, like I say, as I understand it, you know, because it's the same incident information that's going to come in, you know, that administrative person would have to report it. But knowing that with 80% of the officers already participating, there were just 13 incidents, I think the expectation is, you know, with that last 20%, maybe you're talking about three or five kind of reportable incidents. And so,
you know, that wouldn't translate into a workload that would, you know, be burdensome.
Thank you.
Ms. Howell, actually, would you potentially be able to comment from a DPS perspective on that question?
Good morning, still. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kelly Howell. I'm the legislative liaison and special assistant to the commissioner for the Department of Public Safety. Representative Story, through the chair, the Department of Public Safety already collects a lot of data from law enforcement agencies to report that information up to the FBI. Uniform crime reporting statistics is one of those mechanisms. This is very similar to that, in which agencies provide that information to the Department of Public Safety and report that up to the FBI. The good news is that there are efficiencies that are currently underway for agencies to provide this information. Our staff at the Department of Public Safety and our specific units are actually training and reaching out to agencies to encourage their participation. It is voluntary currently through the FBI. So we reach out and encourage agencies to participate, explain what the process is to do so, and we are pursuing additional federal grant funds to assist in creating an easier way for agencies to actually submit that information. Mr. Chairman, I do believe we also have Lisa Perrington online, and she oversees our the UCR program and our Criminal Records and Identification Bureau, and is the subject matter expert on this reporting collection effort, if the committee has any questions for her directly.
And Lisa Perrington is online. And I guess maybe as a follow-up to Representative Tarr's testimony, that there's sort of 80% of the kind of data that we're interested in is already being captured. So it's really about trying to close the gap on this last 20% with these smaller law enforcement agencies. And do you have is there a more precise sense of the numbers, or, you know, ballpark, is that right?
Mr. Chairman, Kelly Howell for the record again. I'm going to defer to Lisa Perrington. She'll have the most accurate numbers and can provide you with that.
Ms. Perrington, if you can speak to that question and put yourself on record.
For the record, Lisa Perrington with the Department of Public Safety, Criminal Records and Identification Bureau Chief. To the chair, the number of agencies that we have currently reporting, we have 20 agencies that are registered to report. We have another one that's underway to sign up to start reporting. And of those agencies, five of them have less than 10 officers with their department. So we're already seeing some of the smaller departments are reporting the data because of the number of incidents that the smaller police departments often see through their caseload each year. They're very fortunate that they very rarely have any incidents that would meet the FBI's definition. So most of them, they're just going in on a monthly basis to say that they had no qualifying incident.
Thank you. Any further questions from those in the room? Representative Eastman.
Thank you, to the chair. Question for the sponsor. Is this a good time to ask that?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay.
So there are a few items in the bill I think are worth highlighting. And my first question is the transition employment. Currently in Section 12, you have a requirement if certain law enforcement individuals and correction individuals are going to continue to keep their jobs here in Alaska, they have to complete the requirements in 1865-240 within 1 year time. Otherwise, they can no longer be employed. And I'm wondering, given that we have a hard time recruiting law enforcement correction officers in this state, is it necessary to create that kind of requirement if individuals have been serving in a good manner and have a good, you know, employment history under their belt, but they can't or won't meet these new requirements that others, you know, fulfilled that their municipality has chosen not to require of them? Should we really be giving them the boot?
If I might, thank you, Mr. Chairman, through the chair to Representative Eastman. I think you might be looking at the older version. So in the current version, that's a 2-year requirement.
Okay.
And so that was one
in response to kind of that concern was to make sure there's 2 years. Again, a good portion of the municipal correctional officers are already receiving this training. And so, you know, the fact that the state can provide the training at no cost, you know, it means that they'll have better employees because they'll have received this training. You know, that's the whole point of the training, right, is, you know, the benefit that those individuals who have a difficult job, you know, will receive from that. So, you know, there won't be an impact to the municipality in terms of any cost for them to, you know, participate in the training. The state is going to provide that training. We have capacity, so there's actually not going to be a cost to the state. And the way we've ensured that is by adjusting that from 1 year to 2 years. So, you know, I think from our perspective, in terms of what can be gained by passing this legislation and making it a requirement is that we make it safer for everyone. You know, we know that there'll be a benefit for the correctional officer from having received training because there'll be a whole lot of skills that they, you know, will develop and skill development that they can be a part of through the training. And then, you know, in turn, that can provide for a safer environment for folks who were in state custody at that time. And so I think really it's a win-win, you know, again, because of the capacity existing, the reasonable time frame, and the benefit you have from having more well-trained individuals. I think it's a good policy call, and that's why we put it forward. And I just was looking in terms of...
Representative, I'm going to interject. So we're looking at version A of the legislation, and I don't believe I'm in receipt of any CS.
Through the chair, or Mr. Chairman, there was a committee substitute adopted in the CNRA committee. So we should be working off the CNRA committee substitute.
Brief at ease. Going back on the record, and we have the CNRA CS distributed version /I for those online. Thanks, Representative Tarr. I'm glad we could figure that out early so we're all reading from the same sheet of music. Representative Tarr, if you wouldn't mind just briefly summarizing changes that were made in the previous committee, and then I think we'll all be up to speed and aligned.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So in the original bill, the one item that Representative Eastman had just been asking about was changed from 1 year to 2 years. Again, you know, because the intention here is just to add to the, you know, the preparedness and the strength of those public safety professionals by offering that training and then making sure the timeline works so that there's not a fiscal impact and it works within the capacity of the existing academies. And then there were a couple references in the original version of the bill for use of force reporting by individuals who don't meet the FBI definition. And in your packet, you should have what's called the LEOC, the Law Enforcement Official, what is it? The Law Enforcement Official FBI definition. Law enforcement officers killed and assaulted. That's the definition they use, the LEOCA definition, pardon me. And so there were a couple that we had originally included that don't meet that FBI definition. So essentially what we would have done is said, hey, report this information to the state without, you know, any other place to send it. And, you know, what we're trying to do is align this so that all of our public safety agencies are participating in this FBI report of use of force. So remove the references to the village public safety officers for that reason, and then we removed a reference to the Department of Corrections because neither of those meet the FBI definition. So those were the main changes.
Great. Thank you very much, Representative Tart. Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And to follow up on that earlier question, is it your intent that the requirement for the 12 hours of instruction in domestic violence and 12 hours of instruction on sexual assault, that would be something that could be covered in a standalone program or as part of another program? I know currently there's a requirement that has to be part of basically a, you know, an academy. But when you were looking at giving this information to, say, those who are no longer exempted as part of the bill, does it have to be one or the other, or could be accomplished both ways?
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, there's no interest in changing the way the academy holds their trainings at this time. We just a few years ago put in the specific training for sexual assault response that previously just had the domestic violence piece of it. So I think at this point, people are really comfortable with that. And again, you know, a large number of the municipal correctional officers are already participating in this training. What we will do is, you know, scoop in the last bit of them that aren't and provide, you know, make sure that everyone has the training.
Follow up. And so as we're scooping up people whose academy that they attended did not include at least the 24 hours required, are we going to require them to go back and take a new academy that has the required instruction in it within that two-year period or be terminated? Or can they be, you know, able to accomplish that training some other way?
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, let me clarify. The municipal correctional officers have their own academy. And so I think Ms. Good would be the person who could, I think, elaborate on that a little bit more. So it'll give you the clarity you want between the academy that police officers and troopers attend versus the academy that municipal correctional officers attend, because they're two different ones.
My interest is in this two-year requirement that we're talking about and whether or not an individual, maybe they attended academy out of state, they're coming in as lateral hire, for whatever reason, they're older, you know, they went through the program before this requirement was required, and now they're looking at keeping their job or losing it, you know, over those 2 years that we're going to give them. I'm wondering how flexible can we be in allowing them to meet this new requirement, which previously they were exempted from?
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, you know, this is going to apply after the effective date of this legislation. And so for those individuals, you know, hired after the effective date of this legislation, they'll be required to participate in the training academy as prescribed by the new law.
Follow up.
So the intent is not to go back and sweep in people who've already been hired.
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, I don't believe it could be done in that way because, you know, it will apply after the effective date of this legislation. So, you know, once it becomes the law, then the department would,
you know, enforce that requirement. But prior to that, there's no law to enforce. You know, in terms of whether there are any ongoing training requirements for the municipal correctional officers, and what might happen at a future point in their career as a correctional officer, perhaps Ms. Good would have something to add that I'm not covering, if that's what you're interested in.
Last call,
Representative. Well,
on this topic, so I don't understand why we have a 2-year requirement to go back and catch somebody up if we're not catching anybody up, and this only applies to people who are going to be hired in the future.
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, it's very typical that we just have the laws that we pass be, you know, enforced after the effective date of the legislation. You know, again, in terms of continuing education requirements, you know, for any of our professionals, that could be an issue. It's often been of interest to me that our public safety professionals don't have any continuing education requirements. But for this particular, you know, basically you're you know, drawing a line in the sand, and then you're just saying from this point forward, our new policy is going to be that all municipal correctional officers will participate in this academy and receive this training. And, you know, that's we're moving forward.
And Ms. Good, would you potentially be able to speak to this issue?
Good morning, Representative, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Kelly Good, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Corrections. Through the chair, Representative Eastman, the 2-year, right now we have about 2 communities that don't already use the Department of Corrections Academy for those municipal officers. It's held in the first quarter of the year. The 2 years was requested by us just to make sure that anybody comes in and now will need to be a part of this. In case that first quarter of the year doesn't work for everyone, then having it for 2 years will just give us exactly what you were worried about, is a very tight time frame. Not everybody gets through the academy on time. And so then we are concerned about somebody losing their job. This 2 years will give us just that flexibility to ensure everybody goes through the same academy.
Paula?
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. So actually my concern isn't that. My concern is the folks that either can't or won't, you know, go back and go through a new academy. And if our purpose and our intent is not to go back and sweep up people who are currently hired, then I think we should probably change the language, which currently says each person who on the effective date of Section 9 of this Act is employed, present tense, has 2 years from the effective date to comply with the requirements. If that's not what we're trying to do, then we should change the language.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, so that's how I read it too. I would say that those two communities would need to have their folks attend the DOC Academy within 2 years. So yes, this is a policy call, absolutely, between you and the sponsor of the bill. The way we read it, though, was that those two communities, Bristol Bay and Craig, are the two that currently do not use. And I am not going to say they do not have training. Please know, they very well could have had other training. But this bill would bring them all under the DOC Municipal Correctional Officer Academy. So yes, the way I read it would be those folks would, in over 2-year time, would need to go through our academy.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Good. Let's see. And for anybody online, Representative Vance Kaufman or Clayman, please text me if you'd like to get into the queue. Additional questions for the sponsor, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. So in Section 1, we're talking about basically the council is now making recommendations and going to be putting forward requirements, it looks like, regulations that any incident in which an officer uses deadly force or prepared to use deadly force is now going to be reported. And I'm trying to look at this from the perspective of a member of law enforcement, and particularly looking at this, you know, who prepared to use deadly force. You have to report whenever you prepared to use deadly force. And that seems very broad. What do you mean, or what's the intention behind the preparing to use deadly force? You know, whenever we go on shift, you know, we load our weapons. Is that preparing to use deadly force? If you're going to the range and training to use deadly force, is that preparing? Or is there something more narrow that we're thinking about here?
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, yes, I'm not sure if you had time to review the handout that we included in the packet that's from the U.S. Department of Justice National Use of Force Data Collection, but it is defined in what is meant by use of deadly force or prepared to use deadly force. And Ms. Howell has previously provided statutory references to in our state law. And so if I could ask Ms. Howell to please provide those again.
Yes, Ms. Howell, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Kelly Howell, Special Assistant to the Commissioner, Legislative Liaison for the Department of Public Safety. Representative Eastman, through the chair. So, yes, there are, of course, definitions in statute regarding force, deadly force, and related items. The prepares to use, I am pulling from the Department of Public Safety's policy, which we do have posted online. Our operating procedure manual is posted online, as is our use of force policy. And in the department's policy, prepares to use includes unholstering a weapon, which is a gun or electronic weapon, with the intention of preparing to use it against a specific individual or group, unholstering a weapon and directing it towards a specific person or group, even if that person is not aware of this action, requires a use of force report. However, conducting a building search or similar operation with an unholstered weapon where there's no person or group is encountered would not be reportable. It is not the mere unholstering of a weapon that triggers the reporting requirement, but the directing of that weapon against a particular person or group. In this section, the phrase prepares to use also includes preparing to use lateral vascular restraint where the officer is able to get their arms into position but without applying pressure. That is the department's policy.
Thank you. Follow up?
Follow up.
All right. Thank you and appreciate the department's policy. In the event that we don't adopt that policy into the statute, which I don't see that we are, is that now going to be up to each department to have their policies like the DPS on what their definition of preparing to use deadly force is? Or is there, on the other side, an intent to change the bill to incorporate the department's policy?
Representative Eastman, through the chair, looking at the definitions in statute of force and deadly force, I, again, cannot speak to what other agencies' policies are, but using, you know, the common understanding of preparing to use force means, or preparing to use deadly force means force that the person uses with the intent of causing or uses under circumstances the person knows creates a substantial risk of causing death or serious physical injury. So preparing to use force or deadly force, I think, again, I don't know whether agencies, I'm assuming agencies have this in their policies. I can't speak to that. I can only speak to what the Department of Public Safety's policies are.
Thank you. Follow up.
Last follow up.
Yeah, fortunately, that is the last one. On the Section 6 and Section 7, we have new requirements for just the use of force in general. And I'm wondering what definition for use of force are we going to be drawing on in this statute? Is that somewhere else in statute, or is that, again, just a policy that might differ from department to department?
Representative Eastman, through the chair, force and deadly force are both defined in statute under 1181-900. I read a bit from the deadly force definition, but I will read 1181-928. Force means any bodily impact, restraint, or confinement, or the threat of imminent bodily impact, restraint, or confinement. Force includes both deadly and non-deadly force. So the use of force is referencing the statutory definition under 1181-900.
Thank you.
And Ms. Howell, does the agency have a position on this legislation?
Mr. Chairman, I actually had something prepared. You'll give me just a moment to get my papers in order. It's here somewhere. So the department does appreciate Representative Tarr bringing this legislation forward. The Department of Public Safety does place substantial importance on making objectively reasonable use of force decisions. At our DPS Training Academy in Sitka, our Public Safety Training Academy, our staff teach to the constitutional standard regarding the use of force, meaning that any force used must recognize and uphold the citizens' constitutional rights against unreasonable force. All staff instructors at the Academy are certified in use of force training so that they can all reinforce appropriate use of force decisions regardless of the class they are teaching. After they attend 8 hours of classroom training, students go through over 60 live action and video simulated scenarios during their time at the Academy to help reinforce the appropriate use of force decisions. And all DPS commissioned officers are required by the department, by department policy, to self-report any incident of force through an internal tracking tool called Blue Team. This is a system that's used by over 850 law enforcement agencies across the United States and is a it is a platform to support documentation, supervisory oversight, and organizational accountability. So in support of that, we publish our use of force data that is reported into Blue Team, that is on our website, as well as our operating procedures manual. So this bill reinforces everything that the department is currently doing, our policies and our practices, and the department supports such efforts to increase transparency and build trust with the public that we serve.
Thank you very much. That was a perfect prepared statement. We're right around the 30-minute mark here. Thank you very much, Representative Tarr, for presenting the legislation, and Ms. Howell and Ms. Good for the supporting information. I'm going to go ahead and set an amendment deadline for this legislation, HB 256, same as the amendment deadline for HB 316, as previously stated, and SB 161 stated at the beginning of this meeting, that is, submit to legislative legal by Tuesday at 5 p.m. and submit to my office by Wednesday at 5 p.m. And that takes us to the final item on today's agenda, SB 156. We have Senator Reinbold online, as well as Kelly Toth, staff to Senator Reinbold here in the room. Welcome, Ms. Toth, and welcome, Senator Reinbold. We also have two invited testifiers online, Dr. Richard Urso in Houston and Dr. Ryan Cole in Boise. And also a PowerPoint presentation. I'm actually just going to take a brief at ease while we get all the technology fired up, and then we can take just a quick break, and then we'll be right back. So we're at ease. going back on the record, we've got a PowerPoint in front of us with a smiling photo of Senator Reinbold, formerly Representative Reinbold. I guess that's how I first came to know her. Ms. Toth, Senator Reinbold, the floor is yours to present SB 156.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. This is Senator Reinbold. And thank you very much for the opportunity to present SB 156. And thank you to the honorable members of the House State Affairs. We really appreciate this opportunity. It's been an extremely popular bill. It is directed, the main intent is Article 1, Section 22, the right to privacy, and it preserves Alaskans' right to direct their own health care decisions as it has traditionally been. We've had about 600 emails. I think you have uploaded most of them. We've had very much, almost 100% testimony, including a popular supportive testimony, including four listening sessions. All the live testimony has been positive. And it's been heart-wrenching, to be honest with you, and that's the reason why this is a very important piece of legislation. And I hope everyone will keep an open mind and an open heart listening to people. I hope there'll be public testimony in this committee at a later date because the people want to be heard. I want to thank everybody that's in the room. I understand the room is full and there's many wishing to testify. I know it's not public testimony today, but they want to be heard. I understand there's overflow as well. I want them to know that I'm listening, and I believe many others are. In the Senate, we had very strong bipartisan support for this bill, and I believe there's 14 co-sponsors even before the first hearing in the House at this time. At a very high level, I want to just do the opening statement, and then I hope Kelly Toth, my chief of staff, will do the sectional, and then I'll do a presentation and then invited testimony. I understand we have to stick to around 30 minutes, so I'm going to go pretty quickly. I will like to say at the high level, the goal of SB 156 is to prevent discrimination based on the COVID-19 vaccine status. This does not allow anybody to be denied any public access to anything based on the COVID-19 vaccine status. And bottom line here is, we are an opt-in state, and I will go into that a little bit more detailed. We do not have to opt out of this. We are an opt-in. Right now, in current state statute, all Alaskans have the right to deny, let's say, any type of surgery or medical intervention that the individual is in the driver's seat, and also the Constitution supports individual liberties that we take an oath to uphold and defend. So in summary, Senate Bill 156, is a unification bill. It protects both the vaxxed and the unvaxxed from discrimination. We added some really neat changes in Senate Health and Social Services that also protects the vaccinated from any type of discrimination in the future for renewable health care insurance. And with that, I'm hoping my chief of staff can go over the sectional and the summary of changes that we did in Senate Health and Social Services. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Reinbold. And just a quick question. Would you like us to hold questions until the end of the bill presentation or questions during the bill presentation?
After, please.
Absolutely. And I believe I mispronounced your last name, so I apologize. But Ms. Toth, please, over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Kelly Toth, staff to Senator Reinbold. And I just to share with you the sectional analysis. Section 1 of SB 156 adds a new section to clarify the intent specific to COVID-19 injections. It's the intent of the legislature that every person should have the right to choose their own medical interventions because Article 1, Section 22 of the Constitution of the State of Alaska protects a person's right to privacy. Section 2, AS 1809 is amended, adding a new section, Article 2A, COVID-19 immunization rights discrimination. Each of the following sections in Section 2 are a little bit different. Section 1809250, exercise of rights and access to benefits. Basically, this requires an individual to be, a state agency or political subdivision may not adopt or issue a regulation, ordinance, order, or similar policy that requires an individual to be vaccinated against COVID-19 in order to exercise their right to receive a benefit that is available to the public. Section 1809260, personal vaccine history. A state agency, an employee of the state, or agent of the state may not require an individual to produce documentation of the individual's COVID-19 vaccination status or COVID-19 immunity passport in order to travel or within the state. Section 1809270, discrimination based on vaccination status. It's unlawful discrimination for a person or a government entity to refuse, withhold from, or deny an individual any local or state services, goods, facilities, advantages, privileges, licensing, educational opportunities, healthcare access, or employment opportunities based on the individual's COVID-19 vaccination status. It goes on to say in Section 1809280, objection to the administration of a COVID-19 vaccine, that an individual may object to the administration of a COVID-19 vaccine for individual based on religious, medical, or other grounds. In addition, a parent or guardian of a minor may object to the administration of COVID-19 vaccine to the minor child based on religious, medical, or other grounds. Section 1809290 describes the definition of COVID-19, and Section 3 adds new language to a healthcare insurer that offers, issues for delivery, delivers, or renews a healthcare insurance plan in the group market may not establish rules for eligibility, including continued eligibility waiting periods under the plan for an individual or dependent of an individual based on their COVID-19 vaccination status. The COVID-19 has the meaning given in AS 1809290. This safeguards everyone, regardless of COVID-19 injection history. And Section 4 just means that this act takes effect immediately.
Thank you very much.
And Mr. Chairman, would you like me to go through the summary of changes between committees?
Yes, if you'd like.
The summary of changes that occurred in the Senate from SB 156 version I to version G. Number one, we added the language to the title related to vaccination status and eligibility for health care insurance and providing for an effective date. Section one added legislative intent, that it is the legislative intent that every person should have the right to choose their own medical interventions because Article 1, Section 22 of the Constitution of the State of Alaska protects a person's right to privacy. And Section 3 amends AS 2154-100A9, the individual's COVID-19 vaccination status. In this paragraph, COVID-19 has the meaning given in 1809290. And Section 4, or added in Section 4, the effective date. And so with that, Mr. Chairman, I think Senator Reinbold will be presenting now.
Senator Reinbold, over to you.
Thank you. Is the slide up?
It is. Yeah, I think the opening slide is up.
Perfect. Okay, I'm going to go pretty rapidly to ensure that I save time for Dr. Urso and Dr. Ryan. So with that, the first slide basically goes at a high level of what SB 156 does. No mandatory, so forced injections, no passports, COVID-19 immunity passports, no COVID-19 discrimination based on the COVID-back status, and no mandatory forced for employment, both in the private and public sector. Next slide. This is very important. The United States Constitution, Article 7, talks about popular sovereignty is a type of governance based on the consent approved of the people. It's considered one of the most important, basic, and essential rights of American people. It's an established, irrevocable right to to be enjoyed by all citizens of the United States. Article 1, Section 1 in the Constitution talks about all persons having a natural right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, to the enjoyment of the rewards of their own industry, and that all persons are equal and entitled to equal rights, opportunities, and protection under the law. And as you all know, with the mandates in the executive branch, both in the state, municipal, and in the federal level, there's been tremendous unequal. For example, some are essential, some are not essential, and I could go on and on. But the bottom line is we're trying to ensure that there's equal protection under the law, not arbitrary. This bill, the next slide, this is the American Frontline Doctors Vaccine Bill of Rights. The bill was modeled after this. And the EUA products are strictly prohibited for federal use to be mandated in federal law. This was affirmed in August 2020. In addition, the International Nuremberg Code and Declaration of Helsinki absolutely prohibits any form of coercion of individuals participating in any type of medical experiment. Next slide, Vaccine Bill of Rights. It's neither feasible nor safe to mandate an experimental vaccine. It has been noted in the past, you never vaccinate during, a pandemic, because of different, as you guys know, there's all different types of versions of the COVID-19. As you've seen, there's so many different variants. And you can see that the vaccine, didn't work as well in some of them, like the Delta, and I have doctors online that can speak much more to that. The FDA Pfizer Moderna protocols did exclude some of the recovered patients from their protocols. And also, it's really important to note that many, many people have had COVID-19 and have tremendous natural immunity. And if you look at the Cleveland Clinic research, its natural immunity is far better than induced immunity, which is a vaccination. Also, many people can get allergic reactions, and it can also be a very deep concern for childbearing women because they don't know the long-term side effects nor efficacy. digital health IDs and vaccine passports pose substantial risks to personal privacy and equal treatment before the law of all citizens. And those administering the vaccines cannot give informed consent because they themselves don't have enough data. Private businesses operating with the jurisdiction have no legal authority to require or mandate or coerce medications of any person. The individual medical decisions have always lied with individuals, and that is in state statute still to this day. Here's a brief, important history of the recent change of the CDC vaccine definition. I'm sure my staff has moved on to the history and definition of vaccine changed by the CDC. First of all, prior to 2015, a vaccination prevented a disease. So therefore, once you were vaccinated, you couldn't get the disease. However, in 2015, they changed the definition to the act of introducing a vaccine into the body to produce immunity to a specific disease. And then interestingly, in September 2021, they changed the definition yet again to say the act of introducing a vaccine into the body to produce protection from a specific disease. However, next slide, definition of vaccine in the Alaska statute 1809-990. The vaccine means a preparation of a killed microorganism, living attenuated organism, living fully virulent organisms or other substances that administer to humans for the purpose of producing or artificially increasing specific immunity to a life-threatening, disabling disease. Informed consent, next slide, informed consent. The nature of must include these five things. Informed consent, everybody in state statute and federal statute has the right to not only consent, but informed consent. They need to be informed. The five tenets of that are the nature, they need to know the nature of the illness, a description of the recommended procedure or vaccine, the probable outcome of the intervention, the most likely risks and side effects, potential benefits, and potential complications. And five, they must be given a reasonable alternative method for risk, benefits, complications, prognosis associated with each alternative or with non-treatment. Next slide. When my physician asked me to get the COVID-19 vaccine, I used to sell pharmaceuticals. I think you all know that. I was a district business manager up here for Bristol-Myers. I also worked for Johnson & Johnson and sold monoclonal antibodies. So I definitely understand this industry. When I said, I want to see the package insert. So my doctor went and got a package insert. And this is what he gave me, intentionally left blank. He actually said that he believed this was very inflammatory and not good, that they did this. It caused a lot of people to not be happy about this. So how in the world can a health professional give informed consent when they themselves are not fully informed? Next, I'd like to show you which is in your package. I've tried to give most of you packages. I know that all of you have this in the documents loaded. Your office has done a very, very good job uploading documents. This is a memo from Ledge Legal that states Alaska is an opt-in state from Megan Wallace. Under state law, an individual does not need to opt out of a vaccine administration. Instead, they must give informed consent in order to receive a vaccine. And informed consent is based on the principle that individuals have the right to determine their own health care. Under this framework, adults may decline to receive any medical treatment for any reason, for religious beliefs, etc. It would therefore be more accurate to state that individuals must opt in to receive the COVID-19 vaccine. Next, I think you all are very aware that federal law prohibits any mandating of any emergency use vaccines, tests, etc. And then I've got some resources there. Next, regarding FDA approval, Comirnaty has gone through the full FDA approval in the United States. However, to the best of my knowledge, it is still not commercially available in the United States. Therefore, many, if not most, are taking emergency use authorization products in the United States. I'm going to go next in regards to, we have heard hundreds of testimony. I've had four listening sessions, basically public testimony, et cetera, and it's been heart-wrenching to hear the stories of coercion, and I just want to make it very clear that coercion is criminal. A person commits the crime of coercion if the person compels another to engage in conduct, which there is a legal right to abstain. So it's very important that people pay attention to coercion.
And
next,
Senator,
I just want
Senator Reinbold, I have the presentation up in front of me too, and just from a time perspective, you know, I think we're about halfway through, and just want to sort of flag that in terms of the extent to which you also are hoping for Dr. Urso or Dr. Cole to present as well, and we can also find more time for that another time as well. But it's the bill introduction is yours to proceed as you choose.
Thank you. I will go ahead and skip this slide, but bottom line is very similar language with just a little bit stronger language has been in bills both in the House and the Senate in the past. Wanted to do at a high level. The next slide shows that we're approaching 27,000 deaths, 150,000 hospitalizations, about 15,000 with Bell's palsy, mini myocarditis, et cetera, and the conservative estimate is this is only about 10% of what's actually real. About 10% roughly ends up in VAERS data. Very complicated. I'll skip the next two slides. In regards to, we're now at the Supreme Court of the United States slide. The bottom line here is there was a lawsuit, NFIB versus OSHA. The mandates were struck down for Biden, because of the bottom line is OSHA was never given the broad authority to do what they did. If you want to look, you guys can read it, but the Supreme Court per curiam basically says that that although COVID-19 is a risk in a workplace, it's not an occupational hazard, and it can still spread at home, schools, etc. And bottom line is that there's still day-to-day dangers from that we all face, from crime, pollution, and a number of communicable diseases. So that was a very important that the next slide talked about the Supreme Court Justice Gorsuch basically said federal government has powers. They are not general but limited and divided. It must act consistently with the Constitution as separation of powers. And as you all know, the legislative branch writes laws, not the executive branch. And OSHA's mandate failed the doctrine's test, and the agency was claiming to force Americans to receive the vaccine or undergo some sort of testing. Congress has nowhere assigned so much power to OSHA, and the bottom line is they've chosen not to afford OSHA or any federal agency authority to issue a vaccine mandate. So the bottom line is they're trying to regulate. OSHA was trying to regulate not only what happens inside of a workplace, but outside the workplace if they were being forced to take a medical procedure that affects their lives outside their work. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to go ahead and yield time next to Dr. Richard Urso. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Reinbold and Dr. Urso. I think maybe, assuming we want to sort of equally portion time for you and Dr. Cole, you're welcome to present invited testimony in the 3 to 5 minute range.
Thank you, Chairman, and thank you, Senators. Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Okay. Thank you. Well, you know, I'm here not to talk about the civil libertarian side. I'm here to talk about the risk-reward side, and I think there's tremendous risk in this vaccine. It's been labeled as safe and effective, and it's quite the contrary. The thing that I most want to talk about is some of the data I think will really help you to understand why having a mandated vaccine is a real danger. A one-size-fits-all approach in this case is a danger to patients, and I'm going to give you some data to support that. It's especially this way in the COVID recover. We have basically likely up to 70% of children that have already been exposed to COVID. And let's take the age group from 5 to 11. That's 28 million children in the United States of America. And so what we're looking at is if we did a perfect vaccine, we would have saved basically about 7 or 8 children, because it's the 0.1 per 100,000 infection fatality rate in that age group. And what you're saying is that if you already have the virus, they retain an antigenic fragment of this virus for about 15 months. And that means that if they get exposed to the vaccine, they'll make a tremendous amount of antibodies. They already have, they're already going to make a tremendous amount of protein because they're young and healthy, and you're going to have a hyperimmune response occur, and you're going to kill many children by mandating a vaccine in this younger age group. So this is not a smart decision. In these patients, there's up between a 13 to 27 times higher risk for infection in the vaccinated over the COVID recovered. But I want to give you a couple other more really good data points. The vaccine, I think you need to know all this. The lipid nanoparticle goes everywhere. I worked with these lipid nanoparticles, and I always say they're like garlic. They go everywhere. They go to brain, they go to bone marrow, they go to adrenals, ovaries, liver, and spleen. It does not stay in the arm. It's been proven experimentally in the current outbreak in patients, right? That's number one. So it's going everywhere, particularly in the ovaries. And, of course, there's a lot of ACE2 receptors in the ovaries, actually, and they're going to create inflammation for sure. Will it create fertility problems? Time will tell. It's blocking cancer repair mechanisms. One of them is called P53, the guardian of the genome. There's another called BRCA, the breast cancer gene, and microRNA 27A. All of these mechanisms prevent cancer from forming in our body. We are seeing a huge uptick in cancers because of this problem of the spike protein getting in the nucleus and blocking these repair mechanisms. It's blocking, number two, it's blocking receptors that lead to activation of dormant viruses like Epstein-Barr and herpes simplex. This is due to its effects on toll-like receptors, which are innate to everyone listening to this call right now. And then we found that it's producing spike protein for up to 60 days. That means that's all they tested, maybe producing longer. The pseudouridine, the artificial component of this vaccine, is not recognized as something that the RNAs can break down. And we're seeing this retention of production going on for 60 days, but also retaining fragments of this for up to 15 months. Experimentally, we found that the DNA is reverse transcribing into liver cells. This means that potentially, like with many diseases like that are reverse transcribed, you could carry in your DNA and eventually pass it down to your children if the right combination of events occurs. We have not seen that happen in living people, but it's happening in experimental models. So I don't think any of you have heard that. And if you hear the data from England and Scotland, where there is no corrupted data, they actually have prospective data, the triple vaxxed are now accounting for 90% of the deaths. This is important. And I think it's extremely important to hear this last fact, which I'll give you and then I'll turn it over to Ryan Cole, is that there's been a 40% rise in deaths in 2021 and from 18 to 64, and there was an 82% rise in deaths from 25 to 44 in the last quarter. And it only begs the question is, what is killing all these people? And I think we probably know what the answer to that is. So going forward and having a vaccine mandate for such a dangerous product it doesn't make sense. If there's risk, there must be choice. Thank you.
And Dr. Cole, you're next up, and I'm going to give 3 minutes here just because we're running a little bit over. But Dr. Cole, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll try to be quick here. Thank you, Dr. Reinbold. Thank you, Dr. Urso. Dr. Ryan Cole, board-certified Mayo Clinic-trained pathologist, background in immunology and virology. Dr. Urso is correct. These are all risk and no reward at this point. No one in America has received informed consent with these shots, as they are experimental and only emergency authorized. It would be unethical for me to require any patient to be forcibly included in an experiment if I were running one. That's what we've been doing. No one in America has received informed consent because the ingredients haven't been listed nor given to anyone who's taken these shots. The spike protein through the Salk Institute we know is the toxin of the virus. The shots make our body into spike protein factories. That spike protein induces all the same changes of the disease that the virus itself can cause. We have a false dichotomy of vaccinated and unvaccinated. The majority of Americans are COVID recovered, and the COVID recovered natural immunity is 13 to 30 times better than a vaccinal immunity, according to studies out of Israel and Qatar. Those who are vaccinated, the vaccine, the shot, does not prevent carriage of the virus, does not prevent transmission of the virus, does not prevent disease from the virus, does not prevent death from the virus, per Dr. Urso's comment on the UK data showing 9 out of 10 people in the United Kingdom that are dying have been double or triple vaccinated. These are not vaccines, as they only decrease symptoms. They do not provide immunity. The vaccine technically is expired. This is still the formulation in all of these shots against Wuhan, which went extinct over a year ago. The vaccines were not tested against Delta nor Omicron. These shots are expired. In fact, we see in data out of the United Kingdom, those who have received 2 or 3 shots are acquiring the virus at a 2 to 5 times increased rate over those who have not received the shots. Anybody who has had COVID and received the shot has a 2 to 4 times increased risk of adverse reactions. It is not only unscientific, it is immoral and unethical for anyone to require anyone to get a shot for a virus that does not exist and does not work against the present virus circulating in the population. It will never work, as COVID always mutates. Coronaviruses, this family of viruses, will always mutate ahead of what we are doing in the laboratory. And one more point is the study in Nature that just came out by Caroline Junquera shows that we're now seeing antibody-dependent enhancement in this disease, which means anyone who gets the shot and or COVID has an enhanced risk upon exposure to the next variant. So I think that's 3 minutes. These shots are expired. These shots don't cover the virus present. It is all risk, no benefit. The majority of people have had COVID. This is now a moot point scientifically. And I thank you, Mr. Chair, for your time. And thank you, Senator Reinbold, for the invitation to share.
Thank you for the invited testimony, Dr. Cole. So that, I think, wraps up the bill presentation. And thank you, Ms. Toth and Senator Reinbold, for presenting, and also concludes the fourth of four agenda items on today's agenda. A couple of notes for next week. In addition to the amendment deadlines previously communicated, there may be additional pieces of legislation added to the two bill hearings beyond those presently noticed under bills previously heard. So my office will be in touch as we sort of assess schedule and relative time and time budgeting. But thank you again, Senator Reinbold and Ms. Toth. And thank you, Sophia, and also Lydia, who's beaming in online with House Records for facilitating today's meeting, as well as Jeff Stepp, who earned, I think, much deserved kudos from the senator. So at 12:52, we are adjourned.